Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio, hosted by serial entrepreneur Denise Griffiths. Denise offers a full menu of on-the-web services for all your online needs. Denise and her team of virtual assistants can help manage your online business, including social media channels, blogs, web portals, and more. YourOfficeOnTheWeb.com is a comprehensive resource to help you combine the power of your brand, your connections, and innovative ideas to develop a full online strategy that can guarantee a strong, profitable impact on your business.
Welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio. I'm your host, Denise Griffiths, and each week I am truly honored to share the microphone with really interesting people. Now, these are people who are business leaders, they're entrepreneurs, they have wonderful stories to share, and they are here and excited to freely share their journeys, their business wisdom, their tips, and an actionable advice. I can do this. In short, they are willing to help us shorten our learning curve as we navigate the know, like, and trust economy. And in fact, my guests are so compelling and so insightful that this podcast was recently written up on Inc.com as one of the best business podcasts that you need to be listening to now, right now, and has been mentioned on Entrepreneur and MSNBC. And our topic today, I think, is an important one. It's called Courageous Conversations with Jane Boffus. Now, Jane Boffus is a best-selling author, international speaker, and business coach. When she was suddenly widowed at a very early age with a young daughter and a financial tsunami coming her way, she stopped and took stock and has since opened her heart and shared her rise from the depths of despair to learning to live and love again. Her book, With the Stroke of a Pen, Claim Your Life, is an educational as well as inspirational book, which has gained acclaim and recognition as a much-needed, thought-provoking planning resource for families, individuals, and business owners alike. We're going to call it financial literacy for short. So today, Jane speaks around the world helping people to begin having the really necessary courageous conversations to get their personal and financial lives in order. And she's also a frequent guest expert on national and local TV, radio, and is a contributor to the Huffington Post. Jane, welcome to Your Partner in Success. We've been trying to get you on for a while. You're very busy lady.
Well, I'm not as busy as you.
No, I'm just
happy
nuts.
To be
I'm
here.
Not busy.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's delightful to have you. So, you know, what I'd love for you to do, Jane, is share a bit of your story because I know a bit of it, but I want our audience to have a better sense of who you are and why you do the things you do.
Well, I entered the life insurance industry to try it out for 1 year, to leave 27 years later never figuring out what year that was supposed to be. But unfortunately, 16 years into my career, my 39-year-old husband was killed in an accident in less than 60 seconds. My life as I knew it turned upside down and the rug was ripped out from underneath me. And I became a widow with a 12-and-a-half-year-old daughter and, as you said, a financial tsunami coming my way. So I foolishly thought because I was in the business and I have education, expertise, a designation, you know, I'd helped other clients through death and loss and whatever. I figured if anything ever happened to me, I would be, you know, better prepared and able to handle it better than the average person would. And I found out I was wrong. So many things blindsided me that I thought, well, if they blindsided me, then, what does the average person go through? So fast forward, I'm happily remarried to a wonderful man who was married to my girlfriend who thought she had a toothache in September 1 year, and we lost her to cancer the following June. So I finally put all the dots together one day sitting here in my office and said, there's a reason. I believe in reasons and seasons for everything. And I thought, okay, I looked up and went, okay, I think I've got it. I'm supposed to do something with this. I'm supposed to pay it forward. So we collectively decided between the three of us that we would share our story in the hope of helping just one other family never to have to go through what we went through. And here we are today. We're talking about this subject. And I made it my life's mission to help people with this type of thing.
I think it's a wonderful thing that you're doing. You probably know, and some of my audience probably does too, but my brother just got home from the hospital. He was in the hospital for 3 months. And there were many times that, you know, his 5-year lung transplant anniversary happened while he was still in a coma, but he's had a lot of trouble just in the last 6 or 7 months with this lung transplant, just all kinds of infections. And honestly, Jane, there came a point where we as a family had a conference call and we were, you know, thinking we might have to let him go. He had so many problems, he wasn't waking up. And we were talking about exactly what you're talking about. How does his wife cope and what can we do to help? And, you know, even though it may, my poor brother, we all have kind of a snarky sense of humor. And I told him later, once he woke up, I said, "You must have been listening to us because we actually were thinking about putting you down like an old barn dog." He said, "I heard you. I know." So he did. He was in a coma. But the thing is, we were looking at all of these things and, you know, trying to, because I had a sister who lost a husband. I lost my sister then. You know, we've had a lot of these episodes in our family, and we're trying to look forward and mitigate financial damage in particular. You cannot even begin to think of what the emotional damage is, but you can try to mitigate the financial damage, and it sounds to me like that's what you're trying to help with.
I would like to help people to get their personal and financial lives in order while they can, and before an illness such as your brother has just experienced, or sudden death like, you know, I did and others have. It's not the time to be running around like a chicken with your head cut off trying to find the crucial, important documents, papers, etc. is not when you know somebody's ill or somebody's just passed away. That's not the time to be doing it because your head's not screwed on the right way. You know, I couldn't decide. For 3 months after my husband passed away, my mother and father were with me and my daughter. And my mother would say to me, "Jane, would you like peas or carrots with dinner?" And I couldn't make a decision about a vegetable. I would just go, "I don't know." So there I was making some of the most monumental decisions, financial decisions of my adult life, and I couldn't pick a vegetable for dinner.
Been there, done that. Trust me.
I know you do.
What happens when people come to you and they have not made these decisions, they haven't looked forward or just thought that, yes, we all do, especially when we're young, we think we're bulletproof. And we just, you know, "I'll take care of that. You know, I'll make a will later." And then they wind up with everything going to the state or the attorney who screwed them out of everything. I have seen that happen too. So what do you tell people that, you know, my attitude is, you're not guaranteed tomorrow. You're not guaranteed the next 5 minutes.
Nope.
You really should be looking ahead.
It's an interesting question, Denise, because this is such a fearful topic. For some reason, it just can set people right off the edge. And unfortunately, it's a taboo topic in a lot of homes. Like, a lot of people reach adulthood without ever having had discussions about this sort of thing, or they don't even know how to run the finances in a home and budget and all of that kind of stuff. So because it's such a fearful subject, what I'm trying to get people to do, and also everybody is, "Oh, it might happen to you. It's not going to happen to me, but it might happen to you." Well, I've got news for you. It happens to all of us. There's two things in life that are certain: death and taxes. And if they don't tax you to death before you go, they'll get you afterwards. So it's about when they come to me and they, you know, when it's happened, unfortunately, you know, as I always say to people, there's no 6-second hotline to heaven to know when your number is up. And unfortunately, critical illness does not come with a calling card. So it's about taking control, planning for uncertainty by being certain. which is things like putting life insurance in place while you're healthy, you're young, and whatever, getting critical illness insurance, disability, long-term care, all of these things. We don't like to think about our own life expectancy, but as you said, and, you know, as I said before, my life turned upside down in 60 seconds. And the horrible thing was that my husband was piloting a small plane that malfunctioned and crashed, taking 3 other people with him. In less than 60 seconds, 5 children lost a parent and 4 spouses lost their spouse in less than 60 seconds. So it's It's about confronting an issue head on. That's why I call it a courageous conversation. And it starts with you, because my husband was 39 years old, drove fast motorcycles and flew jets in the Air Force. He thought he was immortal. So he never wanted to talk about this. So there's that factor. So it's about, you know, talking about it while you can do it rationally, without all of the heightened emotions involved.
Absolutely. Like I say, I've been there, done that. And I recently had, and I don't know if this is going to be off topic, but I want to kind of throw it out there so maybe we can talk about it another time. But in California, you have the right for medical suicide, apparently. And a friend of my brother's, a very good friend of my brother, and my sister as well, was diagnosed with, I believe, leukemia. And he and his wife, because he was going downhill so quickly, and they made the decision for him to go on his own terms, which I thought was pretty courageous. And but they got everything lined up. I mean, they were brilliant about it. They did everything they needed to do. So she wouldn't be, you know, of course she's devastated, but, you know, she's not going to lose her home. You know, they really sat down and they logically walked through it, and he went out on his own terms, which I kind of like, to be honest with you. So do any of your clients ever come to you and say, yes, but what about catastrophic illness that I am never going to recover from? Will this affect my insurance? I guess that's my real question.
That's a good question, and I'm going to defer it, if you don't mind, because just to let your listeners know, I don't actively work with clients today in putting all of the insurance in place. I am really more at the 35,000-foot level about getting people educated and prepared to go and work with all the appropriate professionals and whatever. But it's a very, very good question. And I'm just going to share a little bit of something with you. As I mentioned, my second husband was married to my girlfriend. She was diagnosed with cancer, and they knew it was terminal. So along the lines of what you're talking about the people that you know with the medical suicide, they had time. She planned her own funeral. She went and interviewed all of the funeral homes and whatever and decided where she wanted her resting place to be. She picked her own urn. She picked her own music. The wills, like everything was sorted out on that side of it. So, you know, he didn't have to worry about that part of it and to try to second guess, whereas in my case, as I said, my husband wouldn't talk about it. I tried four times to have a conversation with him over the years as to what do you want if anything happens, but he always turned the discussion around and it was always me going first. So when it came time, it was like he'd stuck a set of handcuffs on me and chained me to a wall, to a pole, and just, I was frozen. I didn't, like, where do I start? What do I do? And, of course, you've got to take his family's wishes, and his mom and dad were alive. He has two brothers. So it really puts you in an awkward position.
So your friend didn't do this for herself. She did it for her loved ones.
Yeah. Yeah, and it was rather interesting. It was rather interesting because I had a number of conversations with her before she passed away. I think she thought because I'd already experienced the loss, I could, you know, empathize and I could help her out and whatever. And I remember being on the phone with her one day and she says, so I'm making this list for him. I want him, I've got all these things I want him to do because I just want him, you know, I want him to stay busy. And she liked to control things. I said to her, I said, with all due respect, give this some thought. If you give him a list of to-dos and he's too grief-stricken to get to them to do them, do you think he's going to feel guilty because you wanted him to do all this stuff and he's not doing it? And she went, oh, my goodness. I said, I never thought of that. Never thought of it. So, you know, we try, but it's,
you're too close to it, I think.
Yeah.
You know, she was and he was too. You know, I think you're trying to do the best you can do, but you're doing it from your perspective, thinking that you're going to actually help someone. In many ways, I think she did, but she probably was taking it a little bit over the top. And
well,
I'm glad you were able to have that conversation, and she heard you.
She did hear me, and that's why I'm so adamant about families having a family discussion about this subject. You know, I'll tell you a funny story. When your listeners are going to go, this is funny. Anyway, when my husband passed away, I planned my own internment because I have one child and I didn't want her to have to go through that. So I planned my own internment. So there's a lovely, you know, double crypt and there's a spot waiting for me. It's all nice and pristine and, you know, smooth marble, and it's just waiting for my name and my date of birth and date of death to be etched in it. Well, fast forward, I got remarried. I didn't take that into consideration when I did my planning because I couldn't decide if I wanted peas or carrots. So it was a knee-jerk reaction.
Right.
So I went, okay, what do you do now? So I had a courageous conversation with myself first, sat down with my second husband and said, this is what I'm thinking. Why, are you okay with this? He says, that makes sense to me. Then we had a family meeting. My daughter was probably about 21 at the time. She's been through some of these discussions before, and I said, you know, when Daddy died, I planned my internment. She looks at me like, oh, where's this going? So I said, well, I got remarried to your stepfather, so, you know, I had to make a decision. She goes, okay. And Denise's look on her face was priceless. And she goes, okay. I said, well, I've made a decision. I want to go 50-50. And she just looked at me for a minute, and she goes,
cremation.
Well, she goes, okay, Mommy, that makes sense. She says, you've loved two men. She says, but how do we decide which half goes where? And I had to do everything not to burst out laughing. And I said, well, you know, I want to be cremated, right? And she goes,
right.
Yes. I said, okay, well, then just shake me up and divvy me down the middle. And my husband turns
right
around and goes, great, I'll get the half that
hefty back.
And I said,
I'm
no, give that half to your father.
Well.
I've been too quiet for too long.
Oh, my God.
But you
and
can't have
that
those
actually
kinds
is a funny story.
Well, and you can't have that type of conversation if it's at time of or if somebody's critically ill, because you can't laugh about that stuff. But we've got to take the fear out of this conversation, and that's what I'm trying to do.
And God bless you for that. And here's the thing. I am always puzzled. I mean, how many millennia have we been on the earth as humans? How many thousands, hundreds of thousands of years? I don't even know. We all die. We all know this. Logically, we know we're going to die. Our pets are going to die. Our corn is going to die out in the garden. Everything dies. Some is renewed, some is not. As humans, we don't really bounce back from death. So why is there this persistent fear? Why do people not get that this is just a part of life? I know that in my ancestors, they had no fear of death. I mean, they just didn't. It was such a part of life that there was just no fear. And has it been kind of whitewashed out of us, or has it been educated out of us? What in the heck? I can't figure that out.
I think part of the issue is medical science. There's been so many leaps and bounds forward in keeping people alive and longevity. And, you know, you hear about these people that are living to be like 120 and all of that sort of thing. I think people look at their lifespan in a much greater number of years than they did in the past. Because if you're talking about the past, you could be gone by the time you were in your 30s and then your 40s. So as more medical advances and medical marvels come, I think people get this sort of sense of, well, I don't really need to face that right now because it's so far away. Why would I focus on it? You know, we all have an expiry date. I just prefer not to find out what mine is. But you see people that are going in and getting genetically tested that they're, you know, finding out. And I don't want to know. I just let me live every day to the fullest. And just when it's time to go, please make it quick and not painful.
Yeah, I'm with you. In fact, my plan is, Jane, that I will go to bed probably around 100, 101, 102. I'll go to sleep, and I will plot world domination as I do every night, and I will turn it over to my subconscious review, and I will pass away very peacefully in my sleep. That's my plan.
That's my hope as well.
Let's see how that works out.
Well, you know, my dad had a massive stroke at 1:30 in the morning, and all my mother heard was this sort of funny noise, and she turned on the light, And she called 911, and he was gone at 8:30 in the morning. And he didn't know what hit him, you know,
right.
because it just affected the brain so bad. And my mother, we lost to cancer, but I think we also lost her to a broken heart. So, you know, I just lost my mother-in-law from my first marriage recently. And she, you know, when I went to visit her in the hospital, she says to me, "I'm ready. I'm okay." I said, "Well, you know who's waiting for you?" Because her son had predeceased her. She goes, "Yeah, I know." She was totally at peace with it. So I don't know. Everybody's different. This is an issue that is no two people are the same.
No, and I totally understand that. We've had so much, you know, death in my family over the years. There was a point some years ago that I got to the point where I didn't want to answer the phone. I just didn't know. And I remember seeing one of my brothers had passed. I've lost two brothers and a sister, oddly enough.
Dear.
Yeah. And I remember having a conversation with my father at the time. And he said, "Well, are you going to call your mother?" Because I was the first one that was informed, and I just happened to be on the phone with my also deceased father at the time, and I clicked over and got the information that my brother had passed, and he said, "Are you going to call your mother?" They were long divorced, and I said, and I sounded flippant, I think, but it was pretty late at night. There was not going to be anybody who could go be with her, and I said, "No, he won't be any less dead in the morning," which was perfectly logical to me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't being flippant at all. I think I was in shock as well, but I just also at some level knew that I did not want to call my mother who was alone and give her that information, until my siblings get there.
Well, you know, the way I found out was a police officer walked up my driveway, and he had gone to my neighbor's house first to get a neighbor because he saw my neighbor speaking to me when he drove into the cul-de-sac we lived on, and he went and parked in front of his house, and we didn't think anything about it because he'd actually been robbed 2 weeks before and they cleaned out his garage. And I said, "Ha-ha, they found out you did not have a riding lawnmower for that patch of grass and they're coming to arrest you." So we both laughed it off. And then he went home with his daughter and took her in the house. And I was painting a fence down the side of my house. And I happened to look through the slats in the fence and saw this police officer and my neighbor walking towards me. And, of course, I stood up. He addressed me by name, asked me if we could go inside. I said, "No, where's my husband?" And he addressed me by name again and asked me if we could go in the house. And I said the same thing to him. Denise, I had this weird notion in my head that if I didn't let this man cross the threshold into my house, he wouldn't give me bad news. And he just looked at me with tears in his eyes and said, "I regret to inform you, your husband's been killed in an accident." And I found out later that this police officer came to me 2 hours after he was killed because they were trying to find family to be with me, but I had no family there because he was a military man. We'd moved around. So my parents were, you know, miles and miles and miles away from me. So I ended up with one of our best friends. It was the one we called. But, you know, I agree with you. What is it going to solve? Now, when my dad had the stroke, my sister called me at 5 o'clock in the morning. Now, my husband was here, you know, and whatever. But you don't want to hear a phone ring at 5 o'clock in the morning.
No.
Because it
no,
puts
and
the
I've
fear
reached
of
that point.
God in you. It puts the fear of God in you. So good for you for not doing that to your mother, because if I had been alone, holy moly, it wouldn't have been good.
No, and you know, I'm the same way, and I have kind of a long-standing rule, probably as a result of all these oddball calls in the middle of the night, but you can't call me after 9 o'clock at night unless your house is on fire or you've been in a car wreck or something is bad.
Yeah.
But otherwise, don't call me. It can wait until tomorrow morning, because when I hear that phone ring after 9 at night, I tense up. And I'm not a nervous person, but it's, you know, kind of like a mild form of PTSD. I guess I just go, "Oh, God." And, you know, I'll wait for the recording to pick up and identify who they are. But my family, my friends know better than to call me after. And besides that, it's just rude. 9 o'clock's the cutoff time. Leave me alone after that.
Well,
but, you
it's
know,
true.
What, yeah, I mean, just use some common sense, I think. Even though your brain is in an uproar, try, reach for that common sense. Don't make things worse if you can't. You know, if you can, you know, just kind of calm down a bit. But what, do you mind walking us through some of the steps that you had to take, you know, once you were able to kind of start breathing again and, you know, going through the grief process? What did you do to protect yourself, to protect your wealth, protect your family, your home? I mean, what did you have to go through? And what do you recommend other people do?
Well, fortunately, and I'll back up the bus just a little bit because I want to talk about even before he passed away. The year before he died, we sat down with our financial advisor, and this is something I recommend highly, that everybody sit down with their financial advisor once a year for a full review. We had reviewed our entire situation, our life insurance situation, and we realized we didn't have enough life insurance, so we actually purchased more life insurance on both our lives the year before he passed away. We had gone to see our lawyer to have our wills reviewed because we had we had upgraded, we had more assets, we had a bigger house, you know, et cetera. And because of the industry that I was in and the designation I have quite a bit of my firsthand experience and knowledge in estate planning. So we'd looked at the whole picture. But in my case, because of the other three people that were in the plane, I got sued by the other three families.
What?
The other three families of the other three passengers that were in the plane, because he was piloting the plane, sued everybody that stood still that day. So I was served with the first of two lawsuits within 6 months, and I was served with the third within the two-year filing period. And they took 10 years to be finalized. So for 10 years, I always had my one foot stuck in the past. But after it all happened, I had to plan a funeral, as I said, blindly, didn't know. Then I had to start informing everybody. That's when you've got to start canceling credit cards and all of that. I remember the funeral director saying to me, "How many death certificates would you like?" And I looked at him like a deer in the headlights, and I said, I thought, well, there's only one person who died. Don't I need just one? And I said, one. And he goes, "I'll give you 15 copies to start with. Come back if you need more." I went back for 10 more. Because every time I called somebody, I remember calling the credit card company to cancel his credit card, and once somebody stumbles over trying to give you their condolences, the next thing is, okay, this is the balance and you owe it now. And we need a death certificate to close the account. So that's all I did, was I just went to institutions and I closed things and I had to pay off things. The only person ever with their hand out giving me money instead of asking me for money was my life insurance advisor. He's the only person who ever arrived giving me money. Everybody else had their hand out asking for money. And I was even asked by my mother-in-law for a death certificate for my husband like 16 years later for something else. So you never know, it's a trickle-down effect. So the biggest thing is, like, I believe that the right professionals are worth their weight in gold. Because I believe lawyers are worth what you pay them so that you don't end up paying more later. Because we'd done all of the right things, I was in a better shape going through a lawsuit than some other people would have been. So it's about sitting down, having the conversations, and then putting the steps in place. If you need to pick an executor, and you need to ask that executor whether they will assume the role and not you assume they will accept the role, you have to ask them, because in today's day and age, executors have more responsibility than they've ever had before. The other thing is, if you have children that are under the age of majority in whatever, you know, state, country, wherever you live, make sure you've got a legal guardian appointed for them. Because if not, somebody else will appoint one for them, and it might be somebody you wouldn't let near your children if you were still alive. So it's getting proper documentation in place, knowing where everything is, being organized, making sure your taxes are up to date. because all of these things have to be taken care of after someone is deceased.
And see,
I
didn't realize, and maybe this is something new, but I didn't realize that you had to, you know, go around and close everything. Well, I did. Let me back up. I did know that, but I didn't know that they wanted immediate payment. I think that's, I find that very difficult to swallow. I mean, none of them would offer you, just say, listen, we're so sorry. We need this paid off, and I'm sure you understand why, but we're going to work with you on a payment plan. Nobody offered that.
Well, in my case, I just wanted to close everything. And because of our situation, we were not greatly in debt. I don't live that way. Coming from an insurance and, you know, financial services background, that's not the way I live. But I know there are people that would have to try to negotiate that sort of thing because they just don't have the stuff in place. You know, it was interesting. I've just come off the road from speaking in front of 300 people this week at a big conference. It was a financial services conference. And one of the things that I shared with the people at this conference, because there's words that I hate more than anything else in the English language, and there are six words that a trust fund has been created, because that's code for no life insurance or not enough life insurance. And I'm sorry, but you can't sell enough hot dogs to replace somebody's income and to keep kids in school and mortgages paid and roofs over people's heads and whatever. But the one that's startling is this whole emergence of what's happening in the GoFundMe side. You're familiar with that, right?
Oh, yeah. I see it every day on Facebook. And some of it I think is legitimate. But I do worry about how seemingly successful people need to GoFundMe. So I think that kind of tells a tale all by itself. But I think a lot of it is also, excuse the language, crock of crap.
Well, I think it is. But where I was particularly going to go to was what really unnerved me was an organization that I know is very reputable did some research on the GoFundMe pages and looked for projects that had the word funeral in it. And this was done last November. And at that point, there was just a touch under 700,000 projects on GoFundMe that had the word funeral in it.
Oh, my.
People were trying to raise money to cover someone's funeral. And that number had been increased 84,000 from the 3 weeks before when they looked at the numbers. Almost 700,000 people don't have the money to bury themselves.
Lack of planning.
It's lack of planning. In today's day and age, this stuff isn't as expensive as it used to be. It's come a long way. So, you know, there's no excuse. I'm sorry. There's no excuse. My mantra that I live by is we have an obligation to ourselves and to those we love to leave this world in an organized manner. You cannot leave chaos behind. Because if you say you love someone, why would you ever do something to put them in a precarious position where they might lose their home, they might not be able to pay their bills? I don't get it. That's no legacy of love.
No, it's not. I agree with you. And funeral plans, you know, just little standalone funeral plans are not expensive.
No. You know, I'm not saying you have to go out with, you know, like Whitney Houston did or somebody like that with a celebrity and, you know, whatever. But for Pete's sakes, at least close the door properly.
And that is great.
But
my plan is to be cremated and scattered in the garden. Seriously.
Well,
no
are
services,
you aware?
No nothing.
Are you aware if that's legal where you live?
Don't care. It's my backyard. My friend's going
okay.
to do it.
Okay, but this is something else. You know, I found out after when I was writing the book, I did research for 2 years because I didn't want to just write. I just didn't want to just share the story because people are very kind and they mean well. They go, I'm sorry for your loss, and they walk away. I wanted to affect change. I wanted to get people off their butts and get them to do this stuff. And I knew the only way to do that was to equip them with knowledge. So I went and did 2 years of research with lawyers, accountants, financial advisors, funeral prearrangement specialists, all of that. And at the back of my book, there's a 33-page checklist of thought-provoking questions to ask yourself and have discussions with your family with before you engage with the professionals. And I found when I was doing my research in the funeral industry that on average, there are 96 decisions that have to be made in regards to a funeral. Up to 96 decisions. I just about fell over. And then I thought wow. back to what I went through. So, you know, there's pre-planning and all these things that you need to do. So it's about doing them while you can and having a say in what you want and also engaging your family and asking them what they want. Because
oh,
funerals
absolutely.
Are for the living.
They are. And let me tell you something. My friend, my brother's friend, my sister's friend who passed, you know, the medical suicide, they did something, again, that I thought was very smart because they had planned everything. I'm sure they had gone. I haven't asked. I don't really know them. But I'm sure that, you know, they were meticulous in their planning and they'd gone through how did they do this and do that. So the widow is left in good shape. My sister, who is very pragmatic, and she was with my brother in the hospital, well, in an apartment near the hospital for 6 weeks after he recovered, while he was recovering from the double lung transplant. And my sister was telling me, you know, my sister and brother, this was the weirdest thing. I've got to share this. They were saying, okay, well, Rick's going to die on Sunday. I'm like, what? How do you know? I'd never heard of such a thing. Saturday, it was a Saturday, I'm sorry. And I was like, how do you know this? Well, they all, you know, family came, they had potlucks. He was already up in bed. He couldn't, you know, really get out anymore. But my sister said, you know, the widow had gone to the funeral home, I'm sorry, and had gotten a quote. And my sister said, oh, no, you don't. She went directly to the crematorium, got a quote that was considerably less. I wouldn't have thought of it. But my sister's very level-headed, got everything taken care of. And, I mean, it was thousands of dollars less, completely bypassed the funeral home.
Yep.
How
you know
far
what?
Is that?
Well, the average funeral today is around $10,000 to $15,000, and that's for nothing fancy.
No.
But there are different things. But you have to remember something. Always keep this in mind. You get what you pay for. We get what we pay for. So if you do it on the skinny, you get it on the skinny. So it's about working with reputable organizations. I always, you know, suggest somebody get a referral to someone who's used the home or whatever. But there's so many different things today. And that comes back to why pre-planning is so important because of that. Because if you're doing it at time of, you don't think the same way. You don't make decisions rationally. You knee-jerk make them, or you make them through emotion, not logically. And that's why some people end up spending more than they need to. Well, I'll give you an example of something that happened. A good friend of mine, her husband passed away. He had cancer. And the funeral home embalmed him. She didn't want him embalmed. They never asked for permission. So when she went to pay the bill, she had them remove the charge because she hadn't asked for it. So that's why these things are so important, that you've pre-done them, you've talked about them, you know what's going on and whatever. But I started off, you said about scattering your ashes. In some places, it's illegal to do that.
So
these
I know.
Are things you need to know. And, you know, the other thing, too.
Can't run out into the bayou and fling ashes around. If somebody catches you, you will go to jail.
Yes, goodbye.
It's done all the time, trust me, but you don't
Oh,
like
I'm
it.
Sure. But, you know, I asked my parents to pre-plan their funerals after my husband passed away. I said, don't do that to each other. And my dad wanted his ashes scattered. And when he went, my mother couldn't bring herself to do it. And she talked to my sister and I, and she said, I said, what's bothering you? She says, if I scatter his ashes, he's gone. I can't even go somewhere to visit him and talk to him. And I said, well, then don't scatter them. She says, well, do you think Daddy would be mad? I said, Mommy, Daddy's loved you for 56 years. He's always only wanted you to be happy. If he knew this was causing you angst, and what would he say to you? She looked at us and said, he'd tell me to do whatever I needed to do. I said, that's exactly right. But she needed permission. And so we ended up burying my parents. They're one on top of each other in the same grave in the cemetery, and they're together in eternity. But the anguish that it was causing her was unnecessary. So it's about the conversations.
It is, and I think they're so important. And, of course, nobody wants to have them, and we just had them recently about my brother. Fortunately, we all have, you know, every one of us, sister-in-law included, I think she picked it up from us, but we all have fairly snarky personalities, which I'm sure you figured out. We kind of do what we want to do. So it's, you know, there at no point, I have to say, I was so proud of all of us, at no point where there's, you know, beating of chest or gnashing or, you know, oh, my God, we were all very calm, very clear, and, you know, he wouldn't want to live, you know, if he is brain dead, which we strongly suspected. That is, nobody wants to live like that, nobody. So,
no.
You know, we were prepared to, you know, take him off of life support, and fortunately we didn't have to, but at no point during this conversation or these series of conversations did anybody cry or wail or say, I can't do this. Didn't happen. And I was really proud of us for that.
Well, good for you, because that's coming together, supporting each other, talking, you know, rationally, calmly, and whatever. You know, we just redid our wills at the end of last year because things have changed since my second husband and I came together, and also we own a business, so we had to put a business will in place. Now, here's a tip for a business owner out there. You need to talk to somebody to see if you need to put a business will in addition to your personal wills, because they're treated differently. So we had to talk to my daughter, who were unfortunately estranged from his two children from his first marriage, so it rests quite, you know, squarely on my daughter's shoulders. So we talked to her about whether she was comfortable being the executor, the co-executor with each of us, and also we asked her about being power of attorney, and I had to ask her because this isn't her biological father, but it might as well be. They're that close. The big joke in our house is everybody thinks that I'm the step parent because their senses of humor are identical. But we had to have a conversation with her, and her words to us and to me was, I don't mind, I will take it on, but I need to know exactly what you want. I do not want to have to make any of the decisions. I don't want to be the one who has to make. You have to tell me everything. And so we have living wills in place that say no heroic resuscitation or life support or anything like that. We have, and this is something that I share with people, is have you made your wishes known because you might be unable to speak when the time is necessary? If somebody has throat cancer and has lost the ability to speak and they're too ill to write it out, who's going to speak for them? Your wishes on paper is what will speak for you. Other than that, you are at the whim of somebody else. There is so much elder abuse going on these days with people that have, you know, dementia and Alzheimer's and all of this, and they haven't made their wishes known, and other people are manipulating and doing all sorts of things. So this is a serious problem, and it needs a serious conversation, a courageous conversation.
Oh, I agree. And there's DNR. I mean, there's so many things that you need to be thinking of. Organ donation. I'm an organ mm-hmm. donor, obviously, but I always have been all mm-hmm. of my life. I mean, since I've had a driver's license, I've been an organ donor.
Me too.
You know, there are just so many things that you need to think of, you know, kind of right now in a logical, linear fashion. You know, just what's going to happen if you do pass. I mean, you're still, you know, say you're in a coma and you're not going to come out of it. You're brain death. Do you want to give your organs away? Heck yeah. If they're usable, take them. But a lot of people don't think about that.
Well, and the other thing, too, is sometimes the other person goes off the rails. They go, I don't want, you're not taking their organs. I'm not letting you take their organs. They're an organ donor over my dead body. So it causes unnecessary anguish and distress and whatever. These are things you have to talk about. I was talking to a lady the other day who said that she was at the ski hill over the winter holidays, and she had my book with her, and her kids were skiing, and her husband was in the bar because she was a designated driver. And so she's reading my book, and she says, I got up and walked into the bar and said to my husband, we need to talk. And he said, about what? So she told him, he goes, I don't want to talk about that. And she goes, we have to talk about this. So it happened. They had a 3.5-hour drive home from the ski hill. So while she had them all in the car and they couldn't get out, she brought the conversation up. And she has a 10-year-old son and a 12.5-year-old daughter. So they had all immigrated from Australia. They had no family in the country. So they kept talking and talking. So then there was a bit of a lull. And she says, all of a sudden, my daughter pipes up from the back seat and says, Mom, what about your organs? Do you want to donate them?
Right.
So they had that whole discussion. And so she says to her 10-year-old son, Harrison, so Harrison, what do you think you would want down the road? He goes, well, I hope I'm dead before anybody takes any.
Logical.
But she said, we laughed about it. We almost cried a couple of times, but she says, it turned out to be the best conversation we've ever had as a family. And she said, I could see my kids felt better because they knew what the plans were. If something happened to Mom and Dad, they weren't going to become orphans, you know, who, but we have to have these kinds of discussions. Way back when, families used to talk about this. You know, I remember talking with my hairdresser once, she's Italian, and she says, huh, we talked about this every Sunday night at the dinner table with my grandmother alive. North Americans, for some reason, we don't talk about it. It's like taboo.
No, don't. Yeah, in my family, we do talk about things like that. Mm-hmm. We tend to be franker than most people. We'd say, I'm just going to say it, none of us have any filters. None. We all just say what we're thinking. But you know what? It's helpful because none of us are going, yeah, but we don't know what to do. We kind of know what to do.
And I would probably say that part of the reason why your family talks like they do is because of all you have been through. Because you know, it's touched you in so many different ways and with so many different people. But if nobody's ever had anything wrong, then they think they're immortal. But you can always say to somebody, do you know of anybody who's got cancer, had cancer, passed away? Oh, yeah, everybody knows of somebody. But it's back to the old, oh, it's going to happen to you, Denise, but it's not going to happen to me.
I know.
That's the way a lot of people think.
So illogical. Yeah, it makes no sense at all. I mean, my brother, my youngest brother was 13. Well, yeah, he was the baby, but he was 13 when he passed. It was one of those gun accidents. He walked into a friend's house. A friend's daddy had left a gun, loaded a gun on a hallway table, foyer table. And the little boy, who was 15 years old, picked it up and was brandishing around. He shot Chris right in the face. But you know who suffered? You know who suffered? The boy. He was never right again.
Oh.
And none of us jumped to sue him. I mean, we were so worried about that kid. And he never was right. I'm not even sure.
Shame on the father for leaving something like that where a child could pick it up.
It was quite stupid. And, you know, boys are going to pick up things and go, look. And it was one of those unavoidable things that happen, but you know, and going back to what you said earlier about these families suing you, none of us, and I was an adult and married, so, you know, I had not been gone from the house that long, but there wasn't a one of us who said, oh, we're going to sue the family. We were just thinking, is he going to be okay? I mean, he just collapsed.
Well, so you're not the norm, unfortunately. We've become a very litigious society.
We've been litigious, yeah. We are, and I blame the attorneys, to be honest with you.
Well, you know what? My attorney, God bless him. You know, I just had something that jumped into my head that I wanted to share with your listeners because you asked about, you know, what should you be doing. One of the things that I was quite startled about was when I contacted all the utilities companies to get the bills changed into my name because my name wasn't on a number of them. My husband had set up all the accounts because I think I was on the road or something when we took possession of our new house. So he set all the accounts up. And because my name wasn't on, they wouldn't deal with me until I gave them a death certificate. So get both partners' names on all of your household bills and, you know, title of the house and all of that kind of stuff, because it just makes life a lot easier.
Exactly. And that's really good advice. And here in the United States, I don't know if this is still true or not, but when one spouse dies, your bank account is shut down until you get it all sorted out. So if you're living from paycheck to paycheck and one of those paychecks is now gone and you can't get into your bank account, you're in trouble. So that's definitely something to look into as well.
There's so many things to look into. Here's another one. I went to the bank to pay off my mortgage because you buy life insurance to quite often pay off your mortgage. And so I went in and they said, we're sorry for your loss, but you can't pay off your mortgage. And I said, I'm prepared.
Why?
Up here we can do it with a 3-month penalty and interest penalty. And I said, I'm quite prepared to pay the penalty. No, ma'am, you don't understand. You can't pay off your mortgage. So I said, why? And they said, because you renewed for a fixed 5-year term. You're only 1 year into it. You have to wait until the end of the 5-year term. I said, I beg your pardon. So luckily, my advisor is very well known in the industry. So he had me write a letter, and it went all the way up to the head of this financial institution, and it came all the way back down to the local branch manager. He was told to invite me in for tea and draw up the papers so I could pay off my mortgage, because that's why you buy life insurance.
Exactly.
If
you wouldn't even think of something like that, you know, how your mortgage is structured, you know, who's paying the taxes on. I mean, there's so many things.
So read the fine print. And my husband had retired from the military and was in a sales position and had leased a vehicle, and I didn't get involved in his business stuff. But unbeknownst to me, he didn't take out any life insurance or disability insurance on the lease. And when he passed away, I just wanted to cancel the lease and give them the truck back. And they said, no, you have one of three choices. You can either buy it outright for this amount, you can take over the lease in your name, or you can give us the truck back with a check for $7,500. I said, I beg your pardon?
Wow.
Luckily, my advisor had the group insurance plan at this dealership and went in and negotiated it down for me, but I still wrote a check for $5,000 to get rid of his truck. So you've got to know what's going on.
Yeah, you need professionals.
You've got to know what's going on. You cannot plead ignorance after the fact. You cannot.
No, and I know. And, you know, here, you know, I live in Cajun country. There's a large, Cajun speaking. It's not French. It's not even close to French. In fact, I find that people from France or even Quebec can't understand the Cajuns at all. It's almost a patois. But it's interesting. And here, and they're dying out now. They're passing away. But when I had sold my other house, moved into a rental house just before I bought this one, because this is right before Hurricane Katrina and Rita, and we were in the house, you know, we were looking at houses, couldn't find anything we liked, and then found this one online, literally, I think a week after Hurricane Katrina, and bought it online, and I love this house. But, you know, it's just what happened after Katrina was people were coming in from Texas. They were coming in from New Orleans, obviously, and they were just buying houses sight unseen. Companies were coming in and trying to rehome their executives. So, you know, I had a choice, buy it or lose it. And I didn't even see the house until after I got home and, you know, my ex had signed the papers and I saw the house at 9:00 at night. That's a good thing I like it, and I do. But the thing is, I know. And you talk about a good professional. My real estate agent knew exactly what I wanted. And, she gave me the big thumbs up and I said, okay, we'll take it. And I lost my train of thought. I was going to say something. What were we talking about? Because
you cannot plead ignorance after the fact.
No, you can't. But what I was going to say is the lady, and she was a sweet, sweet Cajun lady, that we rented the house from, and it was a month to month. We could get out of it any time because she knew we were house hunting. And her husband had passed, and he was the one that rented us the house. she was left in a position which I came to find out was very, very common among the older population in this part of the country, at least. She knew nothing, and I mean nothing.
Yep.
She had never balanced a checkbook.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't drive. Her son-in-law had to drive her everywhere. When it came time to sort out, and her husband left her pretty well off. They had a lot of rental properties. He was pretty savvy, but he communicated none of this to her, and she was so lost. I mean, I'm sure she's passed now, and I haven't seen her in a number of years. I bought this house in 2010, and I haven't seen her since then, but I remember sitting with her and just saying, well, what have you tried this? Have you looked here? She was just lost. And that
mm-hmm.
goes back to what you're saying, don't leave a mess. He didn't really, but she was so woefully uneducated about her own finances, anybody could have walked in and taken huge advantage of her. Fortunately, her son-in-law was there, and I was there to, you know, because I saw a few things where it was happening. I'm like, can I talk to you for a second?
You
may want to get some counsel on this. So, but I came to realize that that's fairly common down here, and probably in other parts of this country and in Canada.
It's
the older
more
populations,
common.
I think, are very, you know, they're vulnerable, aren't they?
Yeah, and Denise, it's not only the older ones. It's younger women as well because,
really?
You know, you get, like, quite often, you know, quite often the man of the house will do it because he wants to take care of you. It's not meant to sort of push you out or anything. It's just, I'll take care of it. Don't you worry about it. Or you get a situation
where... Yeah, that's what it was. He wasn't pushing her out. He was the man of the house, and that was all it was.
He was taking... In his mind, he was taking care of her. But the thing is, you know, I see younger women who have no idea what's going on in the household because they've become the stay-at-home parent. There's three kids in the house. They're all involved in activities. They're going here, they're going there. She's trying to, you know, she's trying to get meals done, blah, blah, blah. The last thing she wants to do at night is either go on the internet and learn more about finances or sit down and talk about it. She wants a bath and she wants to go to bed. But here's a reality. In the next decade, women in North America will be in charge of half of the wealth in North America. And a substantial portion of that money is going to come through inheritances to all ages. It is also predicted that up to 90% of women will at some time in their life be solely responsible for all the financial decisions in a household. The average age of a widow is 56 years old. I was a lot younger than that, and I know of people who are widowed in their 20s, and so do you. And this is reality. And 70% of women will leave their partner's financial advisor within a year of their death because they don't know them. They've never sat down. They've never been included because the guy's taking care of everything or the other partner has. Ignorance is not an excuse. We all have to take responsibility. We have to carve out the time. So make a date night with your spouse. And one of those date nights, a quarter or something, is about you sit down and talk about this stuff. You have to, because it blows my mind how many young women don't have a bank account in their own name, don't have a credit card. You know, if you don't have your own credit rating after your spouse passes away, you're going to be really hard pressed to get a mortgage in your name because you don't have any credit history. So it's about being educated, aware, and knowledgeable. Sticking your head in the sand and hoping that the issue is going to go away, there isn't enough air down there for you to stay there. You've eventually got to pull your head up and breathe in.
It's crazy. And we're all guilty. Wow. We only have a minute left. How in the heck did that happen? Listen, and I always do this to people on the air. I box you into a corner. We didn't get to talk about your book with the stroke of the pen, and I definitely want to talk about that and some other things. So would you come back again in a couple of months?
I would love to, Denise. I've thoroughly enjoyed our conversation.
Yeah. So you can't tell me no, can you?
No.
On the radio. Tricky. Listen.
I don't think you'd let me say no.
No. I'd call you back and go, what the heck? Listen, tell people where they can find you on the web. And you had mentioned in the virtual green room that you had a gift for our audience.
Certainly. So they can contact me through Jane Bloffus, J-A-N-E, blaufus.com. That's the website. And I would like to offer your listeners a promo code if they're interested in getting the book. It's hot off the press. I just got the third edition, completely revised, updated, new afterword, into my hot little hands this week. And I'd like to offer your listeners a discount on the book. Use promo code the number 3, capital letter E, to order it. And I promise them I will personally sign the book.
Thank you so much. Listen, this is, you know, normally where I say, okay, thank you, and it's been a pleasure speaking with you, and I, you know, tell people about my company, but my keyboard just quit working, which means that I can't even scroll down. This has been one of those tech days where, you know, says somebody's saying, go take a nap.
I think you probably should.
I'm thinking I'll go outside and kick a tree or something. But anyway, it has been a genuine pleasure speaking with you, and you've told people where they can find you on the web. I definitely want you to come back. And I'm not going to be able to end the episode because when my keyboard quit, my mouse quit as well. So what I'm going to do is just hang up, and eventually it'll stop recording.
You're funny.
But thank
you're
you.
You're funny. You're funny.
You know, and I'm a techie nerd, and you know, sometimes it just doesn't work. So.
I felt like I was having a cup of tea and talking to one of my best friends.
Oh, that is that's a tremendous compliment. Thank you so much.
Well, and thank you, because when you said a minute left, I was like, what? We just started.
And we did, and I'm looking at my monitor, and it still says on the monitor, we still have 23 minutes to go, and I was just chatting away, and then went, what do you mean 60 seconds left? So definitely my technology today is not in love with me, and I'm going to say I'm going to break up with it. I'm going to break up with it for the day.
Okay,
yeah.
That's a good idea.
So we will talk,
that's a good idea.
Yeah, we will talk again and again. Thank you so much. I mean, you've provided a ton of really valuable information, and I hope people do get the book and start planning. But we'll talk
again. I hope
again.
They do, too. Okay, and you just let me know when this is going out, so I'll get it all over my social media as well, and tell me what you want me to do to help promote it.
Will do. Will do.
Thanks,
actually,
Denise.
It'll be out in about 30 minutes. The same link I sent you earlier is the link you're going to use.
About 30 minutes.
Talk to you later.
Okay. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.